Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment, I'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips. This week, I spout off about Trump using the Scouts as a platform for his political views. Of course, there's other things to discuss in the world as well. I hope you enjoy listening to our talk about it. Thank you very much indeed.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world. This afternoon's program, of course, has been pre-recorded to accommodate our guests, our foreign editor's schedule, that being in London, where it's 5 hours difference, as a matter of fact, 5 hours ahead of the time that you're hearing this. So with that, as a little disclaimer, just to remind you, Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And with that, Tom, good afternoon, actually good evening to you. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening to you.
And very quickly, temperature and environment there in London?
It's a bit dreary today. Grey, overcast, sort of British drizzle, getting a bit chilly.
Ah.
Not a nice day.
Okay.
A nice day.
I like the term chilly. How chilly? Just out of curiosity. For us, those of us who have been living...
I'd say, you know, low 60s.
Oh, my goodness. What a beautiful day. All right. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, where he complains about comfortable weather. We're, of course, suffering from global climate change, a.k.a. summertime, especially where we are here in this portion of Viewpoints around the world here in coastal North Carolina. But wherever people are listening to this program, I'm sure would appreciate probably some cooler weather. Tom, before we get into some major events happening around the world, I do want to ask about a local event there in the United Kingdom, and London, I think, is their location. The Charlie Gard story, the 11-month-old child who is suffering from a major medical problem, which has resulted in basically no brain movement or brain activity whatsoever, and the fact that the state and, I might add, the European court have decided the child should be terminated, hesitancy and resistance of the parents. They have no control over the situation. As a matter of fact, the child is now in the custody of a hospital. So the parents have acknowledged the fact that the length of time due to the political and legislative dispute have decided that the child does not have a chance for survival, and they are prepared to, euphemistically saying, pull the plug, that is to let the child die. The question now, of course, is whether the hospital will release the child so that the child may go home to die. What's the future of this dispute?
The legal position is the hospital has to represent the child's interests. That is their legal position. So they are acting. They have to speak on behalf of the child in any medical emergency like this. And it's a question of whether or not the child would be suffering unnaturally. Now, at the moment, they are in court. And last time I checked, there'd been no decision. It looks as if, you know, I would say, looking at the evidence, things like that, Charlie will either leave the hospital and go to a hospice, or he will leave the hospital and go home. The parents have located volunteer doctors and nurses and equipment and everything else that would be necessary to look after Charlie to ensure that he does not suffer any pain in his final days. The thing is that the life support system will be pulled off or taken off, or the plug will be pulled on the 31st of July. What has happened is that the doctor has come from the States, who they were hoping would give evidence to say that he could go to America. He has done a diagnosis, and he's looked at Charlie very carefully and said, no, there is no hope. There's no point in his going to the States. I often say that a lot of these things, the decision isn't between good and bad, but between bad and worse. And this is certainly one of those very sad cases.
I want you to know that this is playing a big role in conversations related to national health care in the States. Now, the story itself about Charlie Gard has been very small, very short, but still, it is an issue that's being raised relative to the concept of national health care. Just for your benefit, I'm not going to get into the details.
It is not a financial issue.
Oh, no. It's
not a question of whether or not the state can afford to keep Charlie. It's a question of Charlie suffering.
Well, it's also a matter of whether or not it warrants the effort to maintain his life long term. But we don't need to get into a long discussion on that. But I just think it's interesting, and I just thought I'd share that bit of information with you as well. Let's move on to some big issues, and I think we want to start with the states here, the United States, and I'm curious about the coverage of the events in Washington, D.C., recently with the investigation of the now in the states, we call it a hackneyed Russian story. We're tired of it. But how is it being played there in Europe?
Well, it's still big front page news here. I think it's generally regarded that the written testimony of Jared Kushner was a bit of a damp squib. People were rather looking forward to him being cross-examined by the Intelligence Committee, but it all went behind closed doors. They're a bit surprised that nothing has come, that they have not called upon either Paul Manafort or Trump Jr. to appear before the committee, as they were supposed to, or they were expected to. They're looking increasingly at the Attorney General, and it really is amazing in a lot of people's views that Trump is talking about getting rid of a man who he thought was absolutely fantastic 6 months ago and was one of his earliest supporters and is now believed not to be up to the job. And they think it just underscores the whole weakness of the Trump administration. And also increasingly, people are saying that Trump's main criteria appears to be total loyalty to President Trump, not to the Constitution of the United States, but to the president.
Right. All right. Now, what about the have you had much in the way of news related to also, well, rocky relations between the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and the president as well? And of course, Secretary Tillerson is someone who is really the public face for this administration and their country, particularly around the world. Any stories, any comments about that?
There hasn't been reported big time yet, but it's not a surprise because, of course, the State Department is having its budget slashed by nearly 30%. And on top of that, the president's son-in-law seems to be conducting foreign policy rather than the Secretary of State. And this must lead to some friction between Rex Tillerson and the White House.
Is that, so his son-in-law, Kushner, is being recognized as a representative of the State Department in some regards. And I don't mean that officially, but unofficially.
Yes, he not of the State Department, but of the Trump administration's foreign policy.
This is going to be interesting to see how this plays out. All right. Before we move on to other items, we've got a break coming up in about 2 minutes. Let's talk about the play related to the Boy Scout presentation, which, of course, is now being criticized. I saw the Washington Post story about that this morning. The president visited the Jamboree. What's been the play there in the UK?
Well, it's been, you know, very heavily criticized, and I want to join the criticism because I'm an Eagle Scout. I have also run a scout group here in the UK for the past 20 years. And I consider myself a scout. And to me, the values of scouting transcend politics. And a scouting event should never, ever, ever be used as a political platform. And to do so is beneath contempt.
So you did not agree with his presentation either?
I definitely did not agree. I think he really did major damage to himself. He did damage to the scout movement. He did damage to the dignity of the office of the presidency.
I don't know that he did so much damage to the scout movement. I mean, the scouts were there.
No, and by dragging the scouts into political debate, he has done damage to the scout movement, and he should not be allowed to do that.
Well, I mean, there's...
I feel very strongly about this.
Okay.
Because I'm very much involved in the scout movement.
Well, congratulations to you. And by the way, how strong, before we wrap it up, how strong is the scout movement in the UK?
It's very strong. I mean, okay. It started here.
Okay. I just wonder if...
The only problem we have here is we have a million children in scouts, but we don't have enough scout leaders. You know, we don't have enough volunteers. And I think it's probably a problem you have right around the world.
That you're absolutely right. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, who we've just discovered himself is an Eagle Scout. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com's expanded world analysis for the week being the 31st of July. Look Ahead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. Lots of big trials next week. On Thursday, former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych goes on trial for treason. But he won't be there. Yanukovych fled to Moscow after he was overthrown by pro-European demonstrators in February 2014. Yanukovych refuses to return to Kiev to face his accusers, having branded the event a show trial. Lawyers for Thailand's former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra present their closing arguments in that country's corruption trial. Shinawatra was overthrown by the military in 2014. Pu, as she is more commonly known, has been charged with involvement in a controversial rice scandal. In Brazil, it's the turn of President Michel Temer. On Wednesday, he faces an important vote in the lower house of the Brazilian parliament. The parliamentarians will decide whether to send the president to the country's Supreme Court to face charges of passive corruption. South Africa is fascinated by the grisly trial of two white farmers accused of trying to force a black South African into a coffin and threatening to burn him alive. Willem Oosthuizen and Theo Jackson are accused of kidnapping, assault, and attempted murder. The Battle of Passchendaele, one of the bloodiest of World War I, will be commemorated in the Belgian town of Ypres on Monday. Nearly 600,000 people died in the battle, which lasted from the 31st of July to the 6th of November 1917. Next Sunday, it is also the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. More than 70,000 people were killed by the bomb's impact, and many more died subsequently from burns and radiation poisoning. In Berlin, demonstrators will mark a Middle East war atrocity on Wednesday. It is the third anniversary of the start of the forced conversion and genocide by Islamic State against the Yazidi people in Sinjar and Shangar, which resulted in 500,000 refugees and thousands dead. The Chinese People's Liberation Army is said to be a growing political power in China. This will be demonstrated when the PLA celebrates its 90th anniversary on Tuesday with a major military parade before President Xi Jinping. The parade is said to be as big as that marking the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. In another parade, Britain's Prince Philip makes his last official appearance before retiring from public life on Tuesday. The 96-year-old right-hand man of Queen Elizabeth II will preside over a Royal Marines parade at Buckingham Palace. And that was next week's news today so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and LookAhead Radio. And just to remind you, tomorrow's news today at LookAheadNews.com. No charge, no difficulty. Just log on and become a regular reader of that. And of course, Look Ahead Radio, heard on radio stations around the world. Literally, not just figuratively, but literally. Tom, let's move on to a few other items about, the U.S. and U.K. I want to bring up the topic of our economies. It's noted here in your note that U.S. and U.K. economies are growing less than other International Monetary Fund countries. In fact, I saw a note that the president of the IMF has jokingly said they may move the IMF offices from its current largest member, which coincidentally happens to be the U.S., to maybe the future largest member, which might be China. So what is the arrangement really, or the focus on the economies, and particularly in relationship, if you could encapsulate that with Brexit as well?
Yeah, well, a lot of people, I mean, let me just say that I believe, and I think a lot of people, a lot of economists here that I've spoken to and read and everything else, look at both the US and the UK, and they say they're not surprised that there's been a downgrade in the growth predictions, because the political structures in both countries are so weak. I mean, there's not any sense of direction coming either out of 10 Downing Street for the British economy, and there's no sense of direction for the American economy coming out of the White House. And so they're both floundering, and you need that political infrastructure in order for the economy to move forward. Now, one of the big problems, of course, is Brexit here in the UK. And that is where there is lacking any real direction. The talks are still floundering. They're getting nowhere. And so as a result, people are starting more and more of moving their offices, or thinking of moving their offices and starting to move their offices to Dublin and Paris and places like that.
As a matter of fact, I just want to interrupt you that I think it's Bank of America has announced that they are planning to move their offices, I think, to Dublin.
Yes. It won't be every person at the Bank of America office, but roughly 25% of the banking done in London is with Europe. Okay, and you need to have what's called a financial passport to trade into the EU. So that means that 25% of the financial business could move, in theory, out of the city of London to Frankfurt or Dublin or Paris. The financial services make up 11% of the British economy.
Wow. All right. So, and of course, we've talked about this issue of the hard Brexit. What's the current status of the British exit from the EU?
Nobody seems to know. There are conflicting reports coming from different ministers. They can't seem to agree. One person says one thing one day, another one says another thing the other day. One of the biggest Brexiteers, one of the loudest, and who led the campaign, a chap called Michael Gove, has been changing his tune slightly. He's been talking about pragmatic Brexit, whatever that means. He's not specific. Instead of talking about taking back control of our borders and stopping immigration, he's saying we need economic migration.
Well, what are you speaking
of? Or economic immigrants.
Okay. I want to get to the immigrants issue. I'm curious. All right, with all that is happening there, and is there some sense that the European Union has, if you will, I guess the best description is circled the wagons and have strengthened their current relationships? What's happening with the European Union? Is there anything significant at this point? It seems pretty quiet.
Well, the European Union, I think the election of Macron was a big, big boost for the European Union. Going back to the downgrade of the economies, the Eurozone economies are actually doing much better. Hmm. So, you know, when you're talking, as we were talking about, or you were talking about, I should say, a few months ago, the imminent demise of the European Union. In fact, the European Union and the Eurozone countries are starting to grow again, and they're growing faster than the UK and the US. Even Greece now is growing at 1.8%.
Right.
The Spanish at 3.5%, and they were in a terrible state.
Well,
a few years ago.
The other side of the equation, Tom, is if these countries are growing, possibly at the penalty of the European economy, but not significant penalty to the European economy, and I'm just using that in relative terms. That's a good thing for the euro and for the rest of the world, because we were looking at having to carry Greece as a welfare state and potentially Spain.
Oh, absolutely. It is a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
Right.
I'm only saying it's a bad thing in that the U.S. would be, in fact, the world as a whole, according to the IMF, is expected to grow at 3.5%
right.
in 2017 and 3.6% in 2018. But it does mean that the U.S., in relation to the rest of the world, and the UK in relation to the rest of the world would relatively shrink.
Well, and of course, arguably, from some liberal points of view, that's a good thing. I don't agree with that, but at least that's some liberals think that way, that we need to diminish the larger players so that we can strengthen the smaller players. And I won't get into that debate, and I say that not with you, but with anyone else. Tom, I want to move on to something very quickly before
we have it off air.
We'll go on to a break. Before we go to the break, you mentioned the issue of the EU, and one of them is a court case, and it has to do with British workers and employment tribunals. That would be part of the European.
There are two big court cases today.
Uh-huh, but I want to go before we go to the break. Let's just go to the one in British.
Tribunals. Yeah, up and a few years ago, the government, the Conservative government, passed a law saying that if you had a case against the employer to take to the employment tribunal, you had to pay up to $5,000 to the court before they would hear it. Okay. Well, you know, we're talking about people who really don't have a lot of money. And so, not surprisingly, the number of cases that were brought to the employment tribunal were dropped. Well, that has been rejected today by the British Supreme Court. And basically, it has been deemed as unconstitutional because it denied people right to the law. It denied them access to their right to legal representation. And so now you can go to an employment tribunal and you do not have to pay anything to plead your case against the employer.
Where did the money that was paid for the effort to make a
it went to paying for the cost of the case, of paying for the judge and the clerk and things like that.
So in other words, the other participant, unless they were found somehow guilty, didn't have any investment other than legal representation.
That's right.
Very interesting.
And the person bringing the case would have to pay for legal representation as well.
Wow. All right, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, and we've heard about this.
I stress this could be extended to things like legal aid and things like that as well. So it could open up a lot of other areas of British law to people who previously did not have access to the courts for financial reasons.
All right, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, Look Ahead Radio, here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, of course, is joining us from London, so this portion of the program has been pre-recorded to accommodate his sleeping schedule, which is, well, about now as you're listening to this program. Tom, we were chatting a few moments ago about court cases, and you had specifically identified two court cases that were important. And this is one related to the issue of refugees in Europe. I know that this topic is going to come up in a moment when we talk about Poland, but tell us first about this issue of refugees in Europe and the court case associated with this. What court are we talking about?
We're talking about the European Court of Justice. Under the Dublin Agreement between the EU countries, any refugee who enters the EU, if they move to a second country from the port of entry, that country that they move to has the right to send them back to the country from which they entered the EU.
Right. So
countries
in other words,
such as Italy or Spain or Greece.
If I arrive in Spain and then transfer from Spain to Germany and Germany says enough of me, We're sending me back to where Spain. You started. You send me back to Spain, not from my actual country of genesis, of birth.
That's right.
Okay.
This was agreed before the great big refugee crisis, before mm-hmm. the Arab Spring, before the Syrian Civil War, and things like that. And so it was argued that circumstances had changed and that it needed to be readjusted. And there was a very strong case for that. But the European Court of Justice has said, no, they still have to abide by the Dublin Agreement. If you are if you're a refugee in Germany and Germany doesn't want you, they can send you back to Greece, Spain, or Italy. Now, those are countries which obviously are not very happy with this. Mm-hmm. They're also countries which, you know, are not as well off as, say, Germany or Sweden or countries like that. And they're going to have to bear the brunt, the financial brunt and the social brunt of looking after these hundreds of thousands of refugees.
This goes back to the whole topic of the European Union. This has been a pivotal part of the European Union complaint and concerns is these refugees. And to a point you've just made, Tom, this was never expected or anticipated when the European Union was created. Is there a possibility that this could further, I go back to my question, weaken the very premise of the European Union?
It certainly doesn't help the European Union because, as I said, you know, these countries, you know, particularly the ones on the periphery, mm-hmm. And we're talking, as I said before, Spain, Italy, Greece, those countries are not going to be very happy with this decision. I doubt if it will be the end of the matter. We do have the situation, say, in Eastern Europe, which we'll touch on in a moment, where they're refusing to take any refugees.
We see here in the States that one of the driving issues for the British exit from the EU has been the frustration, and this is our perception, mine particularly, with the refugee issue and the fact that, well, much
no.
of... Well, okay.
No, not refugees. But immigrants.
Are immigrants. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's clarify that. All right. Let's talk about this in relationship to the Poles. Poland has got some protests underway.
Yeah, it's not in Poland. It's not the protest against refugees, although it is tangentially connected. The government, which is quite right wing populist government, wants to politicize the judiciary. They want to appoint all the judges right down to the lower courts so that basically the judiciary refuses to or ceases to become independent.
Okay.
And there have been massive street protests against this because, you know, independent judiciary is right mm-hmm. at the core right. of, you know, any democratic society. And the president, who normally is just titular, he's just ceremonial, has vetoed the government action.
So the
street protest, for those who say, oh, street protests don't ever amount to anything, they did in this case.
And they convinced the president not to politicize the judiciary.
One of the reasons why the Polish government wanted to do that, they wanted to politicize it in order to ship more refugees out.
Yeah, exactly. And this, of course, is something that still is, if you will, a festering problem in Europe, particularly Central Europe. We have, and associated with this, and we still have, well, hundreds of thousands of refugees poised on the Turkish-Hungarian border, do we not?
Yes, we do.
And I
don't know if they're still poised on the border. I think they're probably... a lot of the refugee camps now on the Turkish-Syria border.
Okay. All right. We'll see if we get to that.
But
this is this issue of refugees is still not settled to the extent that Italy has a growing problem. Do they not?
It is. And it's basically people. They've got record numbers crossing the Mediterranean
right.
and drowning in the attempt.
Well,
crossing the Mediterranean from Libya. And these are not refugees. These are not people fleeing war. Some of them are, but most of them are economic refugees.
Right. Yes.
There's obviously a very distinct difference.
Tom,
and they're coming not just from Libya. They're coming from sub-Saharan Africa as well.
Right.
They're working their way northward. And because there's a complete breakdown of government in Libya, you get human traffickers who are taking advantage of the anarchy there,
right,
and are basically shipping people across in flimsy rafts and things like that across the Mediterranean in this reasonably nice weather to Italy and south of France.
Tom, is there any effort, and by the way, I've got to remind folks, you're listening to Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio here on Viewpoints Around the World. This is an important story, Tom, and this is related to the refugees. They, in spite of the fact that Syria seems to be coming, the Syria issue is beginning to be settled with ISIS or ISIL, whichever you wish to use, pretty much on the run. The refugees continue to flow into Italy, Spain, Greece, as we talked about earlier, and Turkey. The thing that intrigues me is there's been no solution. We've talked about this now for almost 6 months, you and I. What is happening there? And again, is this the European Union's concern? Is this something they're going to have to solve?
Obviously. To start with, they have a joint naval patrol in the Mediterranean.
Right.
And they are towing back the refugee boats.
Okay.
They stop them and they tow them back to Libya.
Wow.
At the same time, there are various NGOs, humanitarian aid agencies, who are rescuing people and taking them onto Italy. So you've got to sort of push and pull there.
I'll tell you what, the NGOs doing that.
As for Syria, in Turkey, and also in Germany, there are, they've done surveys. Most of the people in Turkey, if they were given the opportunity, if they could, they would return to Syria.
Well, hopefully.
They want to go home. It is their home,
We hope that.
And in a way, probably if they did go home, they'd find lots of jobs because they have to rebuild their country.
Right. I hope that happens. Because this is a real nightmare. I am very sympathetic to particularly Greece and Italy and Spain and the countries where
I'm sympathetic to them, and I'm sympathetic to the Syrian refugees who literally fled for their lives.
Understood. Well, that's a topic for a longer discussion.
Another bad and worse situation.
Let's talk here for a moment. Let's move to geographically to, China, but really not to China, to Africa. They're building a military base there.
In Djibouti. Now, where is Djibouti? It is a tiny country, about half the size of Massachusetts. It's a former French colony. It's right on the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so it controls, or it's a fairly stable country, unlike neighboring Somalia and Ethiopia and Eritrea. It's just a sort of stability oasis of stability in the region, from which a number of people have bases, including the U.S.
Yes.
Including France, including Spain, including Italy, Japan.
Here's a question. Why would China want to build a base in Djibouti? And by the way, were they invited?
Yes.
Okay.
They didn't force themselves in.
Oh.
They're giving Djibouti something like $14 billion.
Okay.
Which is a lot of money for Djibouti.
I want to move.
And why? Because they've got 1 million Chinese working in Africa.
Exactly. That's the question I was going to go to. You know, China, if I'm not mistaken, has been very focused on China. Africa. China has been very focused on Africa. And I would argue more so than any other country than possibly the U.S., but really even more so than the U.S. How right or wrong am
I? You would win that argument.
Excuse me?
You would win that argument.
It's amazing. And of course, part of that is the natural resources that are there in Africa.
Yes. And China has an apolitical approach to economic and trade links.
Right.
They don't mind what sort of government they're dealing
exactly.
with.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a democratic, a dictatorship, or, left, right, that doesn't matter. As long as they get access to those resources. And they will build roads and railways and give lots of aid in order to get that access.
You know, I go back.
Other countries such as the United States, France, Britain, and so forth, they, you know, they're a bit more fussy about who they help. China's also not terribly fussy about governance and corruption, as long as they get their cut. And the result is that they are moving in big time. And if they're going to have all that investment there, if they're going to have 1 million Chinese working in Africa, they need to have a base in Africa to protect their citizens and their trade.
Very good point. And as we go to this break, I just want to make comment. I mentioned that Christine Lagarde, am I correct in pronouncing her last name?
Yes.
Who is the president of the IMF, jokingly said they may be moving the headquarters of the IMF to China. And this is, of course, China's efforts to expand their economy as well as their political and military influence. Tom, we're going to get back to other issues here in just a moment with you this afternoon here on Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of Look Ahead News and Look Ahead Radio. Stay with us.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from lookaheadnews.com. The special relationship has its downsides. There's no doubt that there is a special relationship between Britain and the United States. There are heavy steel chains forged through centuries that bind us genetically, culturally, legally, linguistically, militarily, politically, and economically. At the moment, the political and economic links and similarities have a particularly strong downside. Economically, the rest of the world is okay. Not much more than okay, but definitely okay. Planet Earth's balance sheet is likely to grow by a healthy 3.5% this year, and do even better, 3.6% next year. China is the main reason. Its growth forecasts have been revised upwards from 6.6 to 6.7%. And the EU, which a year ago had been written off as an economic and political disaster zone on the verge of collapse, well, it's actually doing quite well, thank you, with growth up a healthy 1.9% over the previous year. Britain and America, the only two big black clouds in this otherwise bright blue economic sky. This week, the International Monetary Fund, which is responsible for making all these forecasts, reported that the growth in the U.S. economy is expected to shrink from 2.3 to 2.1% in 2017. The British are even worse off. A year ago, they had one of the healthiest growth figures in the Western world, if not the healthiest. In 2017, the British economy is expected to grow only 1.7%. But that is not all. In the past two successive months, the Bank of England has issued stiff, and I do mean stiff, warnings about the danger of rising household debt. Wage rises are stalled. Nearly a decade of government austerity policies are cutting living standards, and the queue at the food banks are growing. The public are acutely aware of the dangers of increased mortgage borrowing. That lesson they painfully learned in 2008-2010. They're not borrowing against their homes. Instead, they are borrowing against their credit cards by delaying payments. Credit card debt in the UK has risen by 10% this year. And because they don't have the cash, they're taking out unsecured loans with finance companies to buy their cars. In fact, over the past 10 years, the number of cars bought with 100% loans has risen from 30 to 90% of all new car purchases. Of course, whatever Britain does, America can do bigger and better. U.S. household debt is back up to where it was in 2008 at a staggering $12.6 trillion. Last year saw the largest increase in household debt in over a decade, $460 billion. The American methodology is very similar to that of their British cousins. Mortgages are now sacrosanct. The number of delinquent mortgagees has dropped to 5%. However, credit card debt is up $32 billion.
followed by student loan debt, up by $31 billion, and car loans, up $22 billion. Like the British, unsecured borrowings. There are political similarities as well. Both countries are lumbered with leaders who've created a climate of suspicion, uncertainty, weakness, and an atmosphere of crisis. In the case of Britain, the roots are in the 23 June 2016 Brexit vote. In its aftermath, Prime Minister Theresa May attempted to project the image of a strong and stable leader. Then she lost her parliamentary majority in an unnecessary election, lost control of her cabinet, and singularly failed to climb over the first hurdle in negotiations with the EU, or to present anything remotely resembling a coherent negotiating strategy. On the other side of the pond, Donald Trump is his own Twitter-fed crisis. He's circled the wagons around the White House and is busily shooting tweets at Democrats, fake news, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, members of his cabinet, and almost everyone to whom he is not related to, at least by marriage. Both countries need a special relationship with special leaders to solve especially difficult problems. Neither has it.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, with about 5 minutes to go, let's do some rapid-fire observations. I want to start with Venezuela. And this is an interesting, we've been talking about the conflicts of leadership. Venezuela is a story that, interestingly enough, is not getting a lot of play here in the States, but it is a significant story. And there's an effort to establish a new constitutional assembly, but it doesn't seem to be going well. Your observations?
Well, there's supposed to be elections on Saturday,
right,
to this new assembly. And the fear is that the president, Nicolas Maduro, who is extremely unpopular with a lot of people and is ruling by decree and has been since he took office in 2013.
And in a collapsing economy, I might add.
400% inflation.
Right.
And so, you know, he's sort of rigged the elections so that the opposition party is refusing to take place. And then he's going to have this constituent assembly write a new constitution which will forbid, ban, completely end all opposition parties and make Venezuela a one-party state.
Mm. We're looking at probably a major, massive revolution in Venezuela, are we not?
It's taking place. I mean, we're talking about refugees.
Right.
You know, move over. You're going to have Venezuelan refugees if you're not already. There's something like 40,000 of them pouring into Colombia and Brazil every day now.
Amazing.
Inflation is at 400%.
You know,
there are street riots, empty shelves in the food in the supermarkets and things like that. Venezuela is in a terrible state. In 1970, it was in the top 20 of the richest countries in the world.
Isn't that astounding? And the other aspect of this, and we'll move on to other items, Tom, but the fear is that Venezuela's problems could quickly infect its surrounding countries there in South America.
If we're talking about Colombia, it's still trying to stabilize after an agreement with FARC, which is, you know, not actually even settled now and probably won't be for some time. And so if you get a lot of refugees coming in, that's going to create instability. So,
and then you've also got not a great economy right now in Brazil as well. All right, we'll move on to the final item for the day, as we always like to close off the day with some oddities with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Okay. The term is swan upping. Okay,
absolutely.
Tom, what is swan upping by any chance?
Okay, well, first of all, you have to realize that all the swans in Britain are owned by the Queen.
Okay.
And they have been, they've been owned by the monarchy since the 12th century. And so every year they go out and count the swans on the Thames, and they dress up in their gold jackets and special hats, and they have special skiff boats, and they go around and they count all the swans, and then some of them they pick up and they ring them, you know, so that they can keep them, track them for conservation
purposes. Now, wait a second. When you say ring them, you're not talking about ringing their, breaking their necks. They're putting a ring around
their necks. No. I mean, put a ring around their necks. Their web feet.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. And my question is, how do we know that the swans, if it enters London, pardon me, Britain's airspace, it automatically becomes a ward of the royalty?
And the reason is because in the Middle Ages, swans were a delicacy.
Okay.
And so, you know, and there weren't very many of them. And so the monarch decreed, I'm the only one who can eat them. Unless, of course, you're a guest at my table, then you can have a bite, too.
All right. Thank you very much. That is interesting. Okay. So when do they do this swan upping?
It starts next week.
How long does it last?
It lasts about 2 weeks. And they go up and down the Thames in their skiffs and their gold jackets, counting swans and having, you know, being watched by lots of spectators.
Is it a celebration? Is it a time to, shall we say, party?
Not to party. It's very interesting, you know. And also, they have to catch the swans, a lot of them, to put the tabs on their ankles rather than wring their necks.
I'll tell you what. Catching a swan is not an easy job.
And these people have had lots of practice at it.
I bet they have, and they've been bitten a few times. All right, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Viewpoints around the world here with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.